Today's talk, I'm calling We Will Die Soon, Using Impermanence to Motivate Practice. So I had the wonderful opportunity this week to go out for a night of backpacking. I hiked up to Mirror Lake at Dave Q's recommendation. And I got this primo, like it was only an hour and 15 minute hike in, and I got this primo spot. And I set up my camp, my tent, at like the best view on this whole lake, which I felt a little bad about later. As people were walking by, I'm like, they want to see this good view, and like, there I am with my tent. But a couple of people just came right up and walk through my campsite to get to the view anyway, so that was fine. So basically I'm just sitting there, and I have a mountain lake, I have these trees, and then there's Mount Hood, just, and Mount Hood is reflected in the lake, and I just sat there for hours in my little chair, just and watching the light change, you know, that was daylight, and then it was the sun was setting, and then it was that sun had set and the mountains kind of purple and all that. Anyway, as the sun was setting, and there was just, you know, some of the trees still had a little bit of sun on them, you know, and you could tell that they was pretty soon the sun was going to set and they would be in shadow. And I just had this, you know, I mean, nonsensical, I guess, but just this wistfulness of like the disappearing sunlight, just a little bit of sunlight, and pretty soon it'll be gone. And for some reason that I just made the connection. I just thought, this is what it's going to feel like when I am looking back over my life and I'm seeing my life draw to a close. You know, it's just like, it's just this inevitable passage pretty soon. And just, you know, like this sense, not a sense of tragedy about it, a sense of like, this is the way of things. It's not like I'm sitting there going like, no, the sun, no, don't move, sun, like whatever. But there's still a wistfulness of like, oh, it's so ephemeral. So I heard someone recently, I think they were quoting somebody else. Now I don't know where it came from, but they said, we will die soon. And I love that way of putting it, because no matter how long our life ends up being, it will feel soon. It once we get there, once it arrives, it'll be like, what already? Come on. Like, it will feel soon. Our perception of time is relative. So in Zen and Buddhism, and the you know, traditional Buddhism out of which Zen evolved, reminding ourselves of the fact of death, of imminent death, of impermanence, is a central tool of practice. So I have shared this verse with people before in different contexts, but it's one of my favorites. When I practiced for a month at Zen Mountain Monastery around the year 2000, this was chanted at night. They may still do it. After Zazen, right before everything, after Zazen, everything is the great silence. You know, unless it's an absolute emergency, you say nothing, you just go to bed. And this is apparently just an ancient Zen gatha, and it's often inscribed on their wooden han or instrument that calls people to Zazen. So they'd chant it like this. Let me respectfully remind you, life and death are of supreme importance. Time swiftly passes by and opportunity is lost. Each of us should strive to awaken. Awaken, take heed. Do not squander your life. And then we go into silence. I think that's a beautiful verse, although I have to admit that I have imagined somebody coming up outside my window at night and singing that, like, ah! So I suspect every person here, if you thoughtfully, honestly contemplate how you want to have lived your life, when you're looking back at it. If you really think about that, we usually aren't prioritizing that aspiration the way that we could be if we really had the thought of impermanence foremost in our minds. And I'm gonna ask people to just reflect for a moment and chime in if you are willing. Something about if you were, looking back on your life, how do you want to have lived? How do you want to have used your life? What do you want to have done with your life when you're looking back? And this should be, no shoulds. Or comparisons, not like, I don't want to be such a crappy person, like, just a real, very sincere, has nothing to do with other people, nothing to do with how you feel you should be, but very, very sincerely, what do you want to have? How do you want to have been? What do you want to have done? Paula.
So as some of you know, I was diagnosed with an autoimmune condition called myositis in April. And it's very debilitating. Your immune system attacks your muscles and they start to disappear. Mm. And our breathing diaphragm and heart are muscles. And up until then, I worked. And I would want three parts of my day to be busy: morning work, afternoon this, yoga, teaching at night. And that happened, and I couldn't do anything. And I got depressed. I dissociated from my body. I had to lie down for the Dharma talk time. This time here, it's like 2 o'clock in Ontario, so I couldn't even sit up anymore. And then I saw my doctor, got on meds, but I started reflecting very seriously on death and dying, and I live alone. My husband passed away last year. It's very possible the stress I felt brought this on, among maybe other things, I don't know. So I want to practice with positive attitude. I want to be creative in my day. I want to see beauty in something every day. I am aware of my emotions. Some days I get really depressed and down and I cry, I scream. I know that those emotions will pass. I don't want to repress them. I want to express them in a way that is helpful and authentic and present. And then, this morning I went to see one of my ponies at my friend's house, and I was strong enough to get him by myself. I trimmed his feet by myself. I packed him up and I rode him, and we had such a good time together. But I've thought a lot about death and dying since April. Well, since June 2021 when James passed away, and then April when I became vulnerable. I'm on heavy meds that have big side effects at times that could shorten my life. I'm 62 soon. It's not old, but it's not thing. And I think I look back, and the one thing I'm really proud of is I have helped and uplifted a lot of neglected animals that nobody cared about, that were, you know, nastily dejected by people. And each one of them comes to mind. And I'm really proud when I look back at that. So thank you.
Thank you so much for sharing. Phil.
I have a practice of trying to get through every day without having regrets. So that's a big part of my practice. And I figure if I can do that every day, then I'm good when I get the last day. So
that's a good one. Leah.
I like that one. I'm going to go with that. But I tend to think forward. I tend to think in the future, I'm going to do this. And I know it's a tendency of mine, one. And two, I always think of things in terms of, you know, bigness. I'm going to do this big, awesome, glorious thing. And, you know, it's like, make it, chunk it up into bite-sized pieces, like day to day, like Phil was saying. That's very helpful. I have in mind the great work that I'm here to do is a combination of two things merging. And one thing is the creative act that I'm called upon to do as an artist. And the other is the healing the earth part that I am called to do. It's a spiritual as well as a just existential thing that I am called upon to do also. And so the great work to me has been to merge these two paths. So I'm not, you know, trying to teeter totter between both, like, I'm an artist today and then I'm an activist and now I'm going to be totally fighting the two and trying to do both and all of that. So that's what I intend to do. And on a small level, on a manageable level, you know, do that every day. A piece of whatever that is. So good idea, Phil.
Thank you. Peter.
I like the adage, careful what you wish for because you may get it. I am somebody who is, while I've always denied that I'm a racer, I'm more of an adventurer. Like, I don't want to pay $350 and enter a 5-hour triathlon nearly as much as I'd like to pay $350 and go on a 3-day hike. And that said, I do things fairly aggressively. Like, I have always been somebody who likes to see how quickly I can ascend a mountain. And I'm going to just say, like, I ascended the mountain and I'm alone at the top. And I'm looking down and I can see my whole family coming up behind me and I'm waiting for. And so what I'd like to be, I'd like to look at my life as somebody who then reached down and helped people up, even to the expense of getting off the top of the mountain and joining them wherever they are. I don't have to stay on top of the mountain where, you know, supposedly the view is great and you don't have to worry about having to do more climbing in the future. So, and I am going to therefore, you know, start initiating this right now, offering an invitation and just saying, I'm a long distance hiker and bicyclist and in general doing anything that's done on my own power. And if any of you know somebody who might be interested, this is the invitation. I would invite you and or that person to go with me on, say, a 24-hour bike ride that has no intention of going far except to stay on the bike and just keep pedaling for roughly 20 of those 24 hours and just see what happens. You know, it's, I have done these rides now for 20 years, and I just realized I have something to offer. And it would be very upsetting to me if when I died, I realized I never invited others to explore that.
Thank you. Just briefly share my aspirations before we move on. Like, you've heard me say it before, but there's, I guess, two different ones. And Leah, you made me think of one of them, which was, when I think about, you know, my concerns about the climate and ecological crisis and stuff, there's just there's a particular piece of it that just calls out to me and resonates, which is to stand up against the needless loss of beauty. The saddest thing to me is that there's beauty, natural beauty, human cultural beauty, that is going to be lost unnecessarily. If we take action sooner, we can prevent some of these losses. And so that's what really calls out to me. I don't expect the world to become a perfect place where no suffering exists. But if I can prevent the loss of even just one, you know, little piece of that beauty, it's worth it. But then I'm more of a, like, a practice, and I've said, I would love to engage everything in my life as if it was optional. Which, that's really been sticking with me lately, because so often that is not how I am engaging things at all, right? There's a, I gotta get this done today, and like, just there's a compulsion, and it, you know, a self-investment in all of it that it's not just not necessary, it actually detracts, it makes the effort less skillful, means that I'm less attentive and appreciative as I'm doing it. So why don't we prioritize these aspirations more? You know, obviously stuff gets in the way, responsibilities, fears, anxieties, resentments, laziness, which my favorite, and I like to define laziness as the failure to apply what is wholesome, which implies you know what is wholesome in this given circumstance, you're just not bothering to do it, which is kind of sweet. Like, it's less judgmental in a way. It's just kind of like, so why aren't you doing what you know would actually be wholesome, and instead you're just kind of going the path of least resistance. Generally, we do not live as if we will die soon. We don't, we'll just, you know, I'll chill out and act as if things are optional someday, right? Just like, it's always something in the future. It'll get there. We'll do that then. We'll let go then at some point in the future. And it's probably adaptive for us to glibly go about our lives as if we have all the time in the world. You know, I could see natural selection just, you know, certainly would be no reason for us to evolve a sense of like poignant appreciation of our impermanence. Instead, we're just like going about our daily lives and doing our activities. So who knows why we're like this, but it doesn't really matter. What matters is what we can do about it. So if practice is living deliberately, and if the Bodhisattva lives by vow and intention instead of by karma. You live by karma, it's habit energy, it's chance, it's, you know, whatever happens around you, just kind of letting things unfold along the path of least resistance, just reacting to things as they come, as opposed to, you know, here's where I would like to go. This is this is the person I would like to become, or the practice I would like to develop, the life that I would like to live. And therefore, these are some choices that I can make to move me in that direction. So that's what our vows are, our intentions are. So they give shape to our life. And it is good to live as if we will die soon. Now, it depends on what we mean by that, right? So I should make an important caveat or disclaimer here that all of our practices, if you think of calling to mind death or impermanence as a practice, all of our practices are supposed to be helpful. They're supposed to be beneficial. So if you are depressed or anxious and dwelling on your imminent death makes you more stressed and miserable and depressed, then that's not the right practice for the moment, right? This isn't about just like, if you're a good Buddhist, you shouldn't enjoy life. You should walk around, you know, contemplating death. This is a practice. So is it helpful? Is it beneficial? And it should be entirely voluntary. It's not meant to be a judgment. But the idea is that living with a consciousness of impermanence helps motivate us to practice. Dogen said, I'm misquoting this a little bit probably, but essentially the mind of enlightenment is the mind that sees impermanence. Consciousness of impermanence helps us to prioritize, to recognize the preciousness of this moment, of this opportunity. So this practice, as some of you might be aware, has been part of Buddhism for its entirety. So to go back into the Pali Canon, into the Satipatthana Sutta, the frames of reference or the four foundations of mindfulness sutra, which is often quoted, it's beloved by Vipassana and Theravada and mindfulness schools, mindfulness of the body and the breath. But most people probably don't know that it includes 9 cemetery contemplations. So this is recommendations for monks. Furthermore, as if he were to see a corpse cast away in a charnel ground, 1 day, 2 days, 3 days dead, bloated, livid, and festering, he applies this to this very body. This body too. Such is its nature. Such is its future, such its unavoidable fate. Or again, as if he were to see a corpse cast away in a charnel ground, picked at by crows, vultures, and hawks, by dogs, hyenas, and various other creatures. And then in the Pali Canon, the whole part would be repeated for each of these different visualizations or contemplations in real life, because like monks would actually do this. So this is just the very, very different, basically they're contemplating the different stages of decay. So they might contemplate a skeleton smeared with flesh and blood connected with tendons, a fleshless skeleton smeared with blood connected with tendons, a skeleton without flesh or blood connected with tendons, bones detached from their tendons, scattered in all directions. Here a hand bone, there a foot bone, here a shin bone, there a thigh bone, here a skull. The bones whitened, somewhat like the color of shells, piled up, more than a year old, decomposed into a powder. He applies it to this very body. This body too. Such is its nature, such is its future, such its unavoidable fate. As I read that, I think, I would imagine that like nurses don't have to do anything special in order to do this contemplation. This is, sounds like nurse contemplation probably every day, like contemplating the nature of the body. And I have difficulty seeing this being a popular part of a modern mindfulness class because people probably, you know, they're going to have a negative reaction, right? This is morbid. This is depressing. Might be encouraging hatred of the body, or might increase anxiety, etc. And of course, these negative effects are possible. Again, it might not be the right practice for a given person. But the idea is that a deep personal recognition of our own mortality, a much deeper recognition than almost any of us are going to have unless we have a chronic illness or we are fit, you know, until it really starts to happen to us, we just have no clue oh my God, you mean this body? So the deeper that personal recognition can be, according to our practice anyway, is a beneficial thing. Because for one thing, we treat things very differently when we know they are temporary. They will be gone soon. We pay more attention to them. We don't take them for granted. We appreciate them more. We take care of them. And very importantly, we realize they are not self. So this is another aspect of that, is we tend naturally to be very identified with this body. This is me. If it wasn't for this body, I would not be. This is, you know, it's scary to contemplate the disintegration of the body. That's the disintegration of me. But as we contemplate this, we recognize in what way we are not body. We're not something other than the body, but anyway, that's a whole nother discussion. And then some of you will be familiar with this. This is the Buddha from the Subjects for Contemplation Sutta in the Pali Canon. There are these five facts that one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. Which five? I am subject to aging, have not gone beyond aging. This is the first fact one should reflect on often, whether one is a woman or a man, lay or ordained. I am subject to illness, have not gone beyond illness. I am subject to death, have not gone beyond death. I will grow different, separate from all that is dear and appealing to me. I am the owner of my actions, heir to my actions, born of my actions, related through my actions, and have my actions as my arbiter. Whatever I do for good or for evil, to that I will fall heir. So those are also called the five remembrances. And in many lineages, they recite them or use them quite often. So this is a poignant reminder of our choice, right? Do we want to live deliberately or by karma? We are impermanent. We will die soon. The only thing we can do is try to have a more positive effect on the world with our actions. Do we want to, oftentimes in the idea of karma, like karma just being behavioral cause and effect, we say that we would not be here if we didn't have karma. This is, you know, tied to the cosmology of rebirth and stuff, but you don't have to believe in that literally. I think there's something valuable just in the imagery. We would not be here. You would not be here. Every person would not be here if we didn't have karma. Everybody has their stuff. They have causes and conditions from the past. We have fears and habits and personalities and all of this stuff. And one of the things that we try to do in this lifetime is to clean up some of this karma, you know, to maybe see through some of it, see through some of our dysfunctional habit patterns or assumptions or delusions, and see if we can just, we don't expect to be perfect by the end of our life, but can we just clean our part of it up a little bit before we pass on? And again, like, I don't think it's not at all necessary to think literally about rebirth. You can, but if you, even if you don't, you just imagine, you know, people you know who have passed away, and the difference that's the difference circumstances that people will leave behind. That some people will just have been kind and generous, and people are sad that they're gone, but you know, they're just like, they just, they leave only a sweetness, right? They don't leave a wake. Whereas then there's some other folks, sadly, who, you know, there's just residue. There's residue at their passing. There's regrets, there's unsaid things. There's, you know, the negative effects that they've had on others, which now are perpetuated through time. So how much, you know, I suspect we're all going to leave a little bit of a wake, right? Even unintentionally. But, you know, that's nice to think that we at least, we minimize that. Try to be, leave more positive than negative. Brian.
Yeah, so this may be so confused that it's not really a contribution to this discussion. So I apologize if that's the case. But for almost all my life, I have definitely been that sort of auto-utilitarian who I want to do the most good that I can. You know, I want to be a blessing in the lives of others. And one of the sort of doors that Buddhism has opened is the notion that there may be another side to this, because we really can't even begin to fathom the consequences of our lives. We can see some of the immediate ones, sort of, but even those go on to ramify out through time. And so we can't know. You know, you sort of pays your money, you take your chances, you do the best you can, but ultimately, it's incalculable. So on the flip side, though, there is the Dharma, there are the precepts, and that's much less a means and ends calculation. That there is a sort of, this is the right way. This resonates with life. You know, I see the beauty. I'm not different than life. I'm not standing apart from it. I'm not judging it. I'm part of it. And so there should be a correspondence and a link and an integration. And so, and this is, you know, this is the thing I don't know. You know, I don't know how to systematically, and maybe you don't systematically do anything with that, but it's made me less like I want to use my life as a tool. Because, you know, it just, there's surely, you know, a part of that. And I don't think I've lived in error my whole life, but there's this other side to it that I think, you know, at least for me, is much harder to get my arms around. But I sense is there and worth linking to or understanding. So anyway.
Thank you. I think that's really
confused.
It's lovely, and it's what it's making me think of is, you know, the classic middle way, which is, you know, on one extreme would be kind of a goal-oriented practice, right? I'm going to clean up X amount of karma, and I'm going to benefit that person, and like, because that's all of this is that's kind of like a future-oriented results oriented thing, right? And like you said, a lot of times we cannot know. We can't know. We might be trying to be beneficial and we actually end up being harmful, and I don't know. So on the one hand, we don't want to be too, you know, one extreme is too results oriented. And the other extreme, of course, is saying, you know, it doesn't matter. You can't see what the results of your actions are anyway. So just, you know, turn off your mind, relax, and float downstream. You know, which, so the living place in between is somehow, you know, I guess when I think about it, I think about this is the utility of vow. Because, you know, you take a moment to, okay, here's the direction I want to go. And here are some practices, like really things I can actually do, choices I can make, ways I can hold my mind and body that look like they will get me there. And then I can let go of thinking about the goal of that vow. I think it was Gandhi who said, when you make a vow, once you make a vow, you stop thinking on the subject anymore. which I think is interesting. It's kind of like it allows us to set a direction without then being obsessed about results, right? And like you said, the precepts, so many aspects of our practice are offering us, like, these are good things to do. These are beneficial ways to be. You don't have to worry about, like, looking for the results or judging whether you have achieved them. Just keep doing this, and it's a good thing. It'll be good. So I appreciate that. So this, you know, contemplation of our the ephemeral nature of our life, of course, is continued in Zen. So Zen Master Dogen in Fukan Zazenki, which we recite on Tuesdays, he says, you have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not pass your days and nights in vain. You are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. Who would take wasteful delight in the spark from a flint stone? Form and substance are like dew on the grass. The fortunes of life are like a dart of lightning, emptied in an instant, vanished in a flash. So we've already talked about that. Well, the pivotal opportunity of human form, you know, that's within the context of the six realms. There's many different forms you could have been born into. But whether you look at it that way or not, you ended up in this life with a human body, with a functioning body and brain, and you encountered the Dharma, and you were able to comprehend it, and you have the freedom and ability to practice it to some extent. So this is, like, you know, a wonderful, pointing out, this is a wonderful opportunity, even if we take it for granted much of the time. What does it mean to pass your days and nights in vain? This is something we answer for ourselves, right? It's not about anybody looking at our lives and saying, like, you know, playing Wordle is passing your day in vain. You know, it's how do we want to have lived our day, as opposed, you know, to live it according to our vow. And then I always like the wasteful delight and the spark from a flint stone. So sometimes this can seem a little negative, like we're not supposed to enjoy life or, you know, enjoy our pleasures while we have them or whatever. But this does point in a very kind of maybe a little bit of harsh way at what sometimes our attitude is toward the pleasures in our life. I mean, on the one hand, we could just, you know, appreciate them, we could recognize they're impermanent. You know, this is especially valuable to do in relationships, recognize it's not always going to be thus, and here I am with this being, and you know, it's very precious, appreciate what we have. But a lot of times we're like, just, you know, the anticipatory, if I get this thing, if I do this thing, oh my God, it's going to be so much fun. You know, it's, I just picture, you know, a little kid, like there's a spark and they're like, but it's gone like that. It's like, as if we're going to be able to grab that spark and keep that spark. It's going to mean something, you know, it just, it's like that. So I have a few minutes left. I'll leave it there for any more comments or questions. Anybody in the Zendo, just come up and sit in this chair if you want to say something. Paulette?
Yeah, I mean, I've been thinking about what you, the question you posed at the beginning about, you know, what would your life mean? And I am, I don't know if anybody else is like this, but I'm very much of a pragmatist and trying to be as efficient as possible. Like, what could I, and, you know, I was listening to this talk by Pema Chodron the other day, and she said that the basis of neurosis is avoiding and running away from things.
Mm.
So I feel like that would probably be like the most efficient use of time would be to focus on myself and how I am engaging in neuroses and how to kind of stop that cycle. And then that might kind of resonate out to everything else I do.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Leah.
Yeah, and thank you for this talk. Earlier when I said these aren't, you know, this is my work that I'm doing, I even made this gesture. I'm very focused on what I'm making and who is seeing it and how they are taking it. And so I'm results oriented. And I know that I'm results oriented. And so this is very much, artists tend to talk about this a lot, but it's true. And I'm seeing that in the context of your talk, that it is the process that's important. The intention is important, that I am taking these actions with myself. I'm using my limited self on this earth in this directed way. And that motion is the important part, not what I made. Mm-hmm. And is it for sale? And is it hanging in a gallery? And is it, you know, all this other talk. Although I do think about it, it's not important in this way. So I appreciate it.
Well, it's that, I feel like this, you know, maybe these deeper, unconditional kind of aspirations, they're deeper, but in a way they're not, we can't just have them, right? I mean, I think about, similarly, you know, I want to be involved with climate activism, and it can totally frustrate you and burn you out, because you're doing all this work and it seems to do no good at all. And so you have to, if you're gonna do it and last, you have to find a way to just this, I am acting as my heart calls me to. I am not doing this for the result. I'm doing this because this is the right thing to do, right? So you have to have that kind of attitude, this free, generous offering, right? Which is probably anybody here, whatever work you're doing, to some extent, it just has to end up being like, here is this offering, sincere, I'm doing my best. But, like, what part of the offering is like trying to be effective? So, like, if you completely cut that out and you never stop and go, yeah, but maybe you should be doing that thing over there, which would be a lot more helpful. Or I feel like that is, you know, our practice never gives us a place to rest. It's never just, well, here's the attitude you can have. Here's the answer you can have and the vows you can have. And now you can just check out and you don't have to worry about it anymore. You know, it's the very nature of life that now we're going to have to make a decision. We're going to have to evaluate what were the results. And now we have to let go. And then we so that's a good, very good point. So, all right.
Oh, I was going to say, part of the helps me with it is the difference between the relative and the ultimate or the infinite. So in the ultimate, we don't really have to do anything. We're just a wave on the lake, right? The great lake of being. But as a wave, we have these human needs, instincts, drives. So we actually have to do something, and we do. And sometimes we get lost in that, oftentimes for a whole life or a minute. Yeah. So the point of it is that we really don't have to do anything ultimately. And when we get to the last day, you know, hopefully we've lived, who is it? Joseph Campbell says, you're on the path. Mm-hmm. And if we lived on our path, then we did our best. Mm-hmm. And we learn on the way, we make a lot of mistakes, but ultimately, and the regrets thing too, if you don't have many regrets or you've tried to fix them, that's doing your best.
Mm-hmm. Beautifully put.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. Offer the merit of this, different verse, Sunday verse. Abiding in this ephemeral world, very appropriate. Like a lotus in muddy water, the mind is pure and goes beyond. Thus we bow to Buddha. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, bodhisattvas, mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, maha prajna paramita.